Hi, my name is Queen and I go by the name Queen the Empowerer. And this is the Mobilize Podcast.
Everyone contributes, and so everyone should have a say in how the economy is run.
They keep you at home and they give you money.
Yes. There's an important difference there, distinction between income and wealth. It costs you around 1,500 rand
a month
to look for work, and we need something that's going to break us out of this low growth threshold that we're in.
Welcome to the Mobilize Podcast. My name is Queen and I go by the name Queen the Empowerer, and I'm your climate justice buddy. But on this podcast, we will be discussing a variety of socio-economic issues. And on this one particularly, we are discussing the Universal Basic Income and SRD grants. And to help me discuss this topic, I have a young, dynamic person. I have Siyanda Baduza, who is a junior researcher at IEJ. But also, he's that guy. You know that guy when you're done writing your mathematics paper and he then starts taking out the protractor and you're like, okay, what is this about? He's that guy because he holds a degree in a BSc degree in economics and mathematics, but also he's a candidate in master's degree, furthering his studies in applied economics. And the topic that he decided to research on is the topic of social grants and well-being. So without any further ado, Mr. Siyanda, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Queen. Thank you for having me.
Ah, we are so excited to have you. You are doing an incredible work out there. So inspiring.
Thank you.
So let's just maybe get to know you a little better, you know, because we know that a lot of people think people who are pursuing their studies are a certain type of people, or activists are just a certain type of people. We just want to know who you are, where you come from, where you grew up.
Sure. My name is Siyanda Baduza. As you said, I'm currently working at the Institute for Economic Justice. I'm a junior researcher in basic income and issues related to social protection. I've been at the Institute for Economic Justice for a year and a half now. I joined there after I had done a six-month internship with them, or a year internship that I'd done with them, that I got the opportunity through a scholarship that I'd received to do my master's.
Oh, nice.
So all my studies I did at Wits University, but I was born in the Eastern Cape, born and raised in the Eastern Cape, moved to Joburg.
So does that mean you're closer speaking?
Yes. Yes, I'm a closer speaker. Home language, yes. Moved to Joburg for school, and I've been here ever since.
Ah, I see the city swallowed you up, huh? So what led you to this field?
Yeah, so I would say for me, economics is probably, I was led through it probably by a teacher that I had. Teacher and debate coach, was also a debater in my youth.
Oh, that's nice. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think that there is a link. And I think it was also what she had noticed. So I was pretty good at maths and a nerdy type, but I also had a passion for social justice issues. Okay. And I think she noticed that, and her suggestion was to study economics because she thought it would be what merges the two fields. Of course, I went to university, I studied economics. It wasn't exactly that. It's very cold, scientific, abstract, and in many cases, like, far removed from the realities of people. But it was through my studies, especially in postgraduate studies, where I chose a program called Applied Development Economics at Wits, which offers an alternative way to study economics from the mainstream way of studying economics. And it was through there that I saw how economics can impact people's lives, and it can touch on important issues like inequality, the climate, etc., which don't all feature prominently in mainstream economics.
Oh, we are so grateful for that teacher, because if it weren't for her, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you. And we're also grateful that you took heed of what she said and acted on it. However, I'd like to know, as much as you mentioned that you were just generally interested in socioeconomic issues that the teacher picked up, when did you start hearing about the universal basic income?
So universal basic income happened for me when I heard about it. It was a little later on in life, I think around 2020, US elections, where there was a candidate named Andrew Yang. And he was one of the, in the Democratic primaries, one of the contenders there. And one of his main, like, capstone policies was universal basic income. I'd never heard of it before. But his proposal was to give every single U.S. citizen $1,000 unconditional, just sort of simply being a citizen every single month, so working out to like $12,000 a year. And he saw it as a way, I think he called it the freedom dividend, saw it almost as a way to, an entitlement that people had, and saw it as a way to like boost the economy. And it fascinated me because it went against everything essentially that I thought I knew about at the time. Against the conventional economic theory, because economics will tell you that, of course, people need incentives or some kind of motivation in order to work.
Yeah.
So if you give people free money, you take away that incentive. Yeah. The logic then would have been, that's a bad policy. It's going to make people lazy. It's going to make
people dependent on the state. That is so true. And you even feel guilty. You're like, am I even deserving of such? Or are people generally deserving of such?
Exactly, exactly. So it was that. And I was like, that didn't really make any sense, but it was a very fascinating idea. And so from there, I started doing my reading on the idea. And I think, of course, then through my research that I would later do in postgraduate studies, I would learn a lot more about the subject. But I think that's what initially piqued my interest.
Okay. Speaking of you learning, I see that you are a Canon Collins scholar. Take us through that process. If somebody just wants to get, you know, through the school, what is the process like?
Yeah, so I am a Canon Collins scholar, and the way it works is, I mean, I would recommend it to anyone, especially people who are doing postgraduate studies in fields that aren't typically marketed for like the labor market. So if you aren't studying, like, I want to call them the conventional careers, like accounting or finance, if you're maybe passionate about economic justice, and if you found a way to connect that with the work or the research that you do, definitely check them out. They sponsor a lot of humanities.
Oh wow, that is so interesting.
And for me, it was definitely, I mean, career changing when I received that scholarship. So mine was called the Economic Justice Scholarship for economic students. I wanted to study at WITS. And part of it, which I think was the most attractive part of the package, was that it came with a 6-month internship at the IEJ.
Oh, wow. Where you currently are, they are indeed doing a phenomenal work, because I don't know about you, but a lot of students also in the humanities area tend to complain about it being sidelined and neglected, and saying certain fields are more given attention. So shout out to the school. It's doing a phenomenal job. And so on a day to day, just outside when you're done with, you know, wearing your glasses and being nerdy, like you're saying, and your mathematics, what are some of the things that you just generally do?
Yeah, I mean, outside, I do still like to read. I don't read as much now as I used to before, because I read for work.
You see what I said in my intro, and I say he's that guy that takes out the protractor at the, when you are like done with the end, he's like, I've got this protractor now. You are that guy, because I'm like, what do you do for fun? And you go back to reading.
Well, yeah. I mean, I tried now to read at least more fiction than I used to before.
Oh, okay.
But then I also like to stay active. I also like being outdoors. I love hiking, staying creative, getting into photography.
I absolutely love hiking and photography.
Yes.
Like at this present moment, I wish somebody was just taking pictures of us. That's how much I love photography.
Yeah, I'm trying to get good at photography, just express my creativity there. And then I also love playing video games, which I think is a little more on the nerdy side.
Oh, yeah. But it's also in the fun side as well. Oh, thank you so much for giving us such a comprehensive background about yourself, which makes it, you know, it makes it so relatable to the audience that's watching at home. And just even for myself to say, this guy who's a candidate of a master's degree, I feel kind of like, you know. So when I know that you play video games, you like photography and hiking, I'm like, so relatable. But also because the topic that we are discussing today has a lot of acronyms that we've been using, like the IEJ. In simple terms, how would you explain the IEJ?
So the way I would explain the IEJ would be, I'd say it's an organization, of course, think tank almost, but I'll get to that part. But essentially, it's an organization that's working to see a more just society, and so pursuing the goal of economic justice. It's in their name. And the way that we think of it, or it's defined, is so for example, the way resources are distributed, so a much fairer distribution of income and a fairer share of wealth. Democratized decision making just means like decision making that involves everyday people get to have a say in matters of the economy.
Oh, that is so nice.
And yeah, and then working towards rights realization, so achieving the socioeconomic rights that
we're... So just ordinary people or just everyone?
Yeah, it's for everyone. It's for the economy should be for everyone to participate in it, because everyone naturally participates in the economy, whether they are in paid employment or
not.
Unpaid care work.
Or even if they're receiving social grants.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Everyone contributes. And so everyone should have a say in how the economy is run. I mean, that's the goal. That's how we envision economic justice. And so, and part of that is, of course, achieving socioeconomic rights, things like healthcare, education, make sure that those are resourced and the government is able to provide those for everyone. Mm. And also issues of planetary well-being, because we can't ignore the climate.
That is so true.
Yeah, so the way the IEJ works is, I said there earlier, it's a think tank. It's that, but also a little bit more than a conventional think tank. So we do research, so try to produce knowledge, but also we then aim to create our own policy proposals, so alternative policy proposals
that
consider these things that I spoke about earlier. And then finally, there's also an element of advocacy.
So all right.
That is trying to affect real change. So whether that's through connecting with policymakers or change makers.
Oh, that's the action part of it.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's where I was actually interested, that if you're taking in so much research, I mean, from ordinary people and different types of people, what do you do with all this research?
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, I think that that's how I would describe them.
Okay, also interesting. And also another acronym that we used at the beginning is the UBI, which you earlier just expanded on as to when you started knowing about it. But if you were to explain to probably a five-year-old, what would you say it is?
I think the easiest way to explain UBI and how I'd explain to a five-year-old would be to just break down each of the letters in that acronym. So you have U.
Yes.
U stands for universal.
Correct.
What universal means is that it is for everyone. Right?
Yeah.
No one is excluded by virtue of you being a resident in whatever country you're in. And in our case, we're talking about South Africa specifically. It means that everyone in South Africa would be included in this UBI. And the way we envision it is for 18 to 59-year-olds, because we already have social grants, for example, for children. So anyone under the age of 18 and anyone above the age of 60 gets access to the old age pension, which of course improve those and make them universal as well. And then another element to universal is that it is for everyone, whether they work, whether they don't work. It isn't dependent on how much income anyone has. By being a resident, someone would receive it. B is basic. And what basic means is it would be at a level. So it's a cash transfer for people who hadn't caught that earlier. So it's like some type of cash transfer that you get every month. And then basic means that it would be at a level that is enough to meet your basic needs. So of course it isn't a necessarily luxurious amount, so you know, dispels a lot of the fears people have about laziness, for example, but it is at a level that at least guarantees that every single person in your country or society is able to meet their most basic needs. So we have ways of determining this, right? There are poverty lines, for example, that are based on how much someone needs a month in order to be able to afford food. It would take into account that, but it would just be at a level that's enough to meet all your needs. Income is like...
That is another interesting, because you were like mentioning enough to meet your basic needs, and you're looking at how much people are getting in South Africa, and you're like, with that money, do they actually meet their basic needs? But maybe we'll discuss that a little bit later. Let me not disturb you on that one.
And then income is, I stands for income. So income is, like I said, it's a cash transfer. And income, I think, is an important word. So it's not just a cash transfer, but we see it as income, meaning, you know how an income is, right? You receive it every single month. It's regular. You can plan your life around it. You can budget. So it would be that it receives regularly once a month on the same day. Yeah, and that's how I would describe UBI.
Yeah, I think you just gave a comprehensive explanation, well elaborated and explained. Thank you so much for that. Because like I said, I think my 8-year-old watching this would understand what UBI is now, and many other people I'd like to believe. So, you know, when we're discussing this UBI, when we were doing research, my team and I, we discovered that in Kenya, for instance, they had the same concept running for about 12 years. And then in Namibia as well, from 2008, they did it for some time and they've put it in a halt now. But we've also seen the social impact, you know, with regards to, I mean, crime declining. You know, even in theft of livestock for like 43%, it went down. It motivated people to start attending school. You know, it sorted out a lot of socioeconomic issues that you wouldn't have probably related it to the grant, but it actually did that. And here in South Africa, it was introduced. Like you said, we have the one for children and for the pensioners, but we started hearing about the SRD grant in 2020 during the COVID year. Perhaps you could just take us through why should we have those, or why do we have that, or who benefits from that?
So who benefits from it? I would start by saying, I think, just to touch briefly on the examples that you gave, I think the real magic with cash is when you create policy, especially around cash, giving people money, is money isn't prescriptive, right? We all have different challenges that we face.
Yeah.
But what money does is, instead of policymakers trying to figure out exactly what it is that people are dealing with and maybe targeting specific policies to those, it allows people to solve their own constraints. So if someone wants to take their children to school, but they don't have enough money, for example, to keep them at school, and it would be more profitable for them to take them out and put them in child labor, cash can solve that issue, which would explain things like education increasing. Similarly, if someone runs a business or wants to open a business but doesn't have enough money for startup capital, cash again is something that allows them to overcome that specific constraint they're looking at there. If you want to search for work but you don't have enough money to look for work, then cash allows that. You can't really get that with any other type of policy, because, for example, things like food vouchers are very prescriptive. It assumes, of course, that the only issue you face is hunger.
Whereas you might just be an entrepreneur, somebody who wants to start a business.
Exactly. So that's really the magic of cash and cash transfers. The SRD grant specifically, I mean, it came out in South Africa in 2020.
Yeah.
And it was during the COVID years. And the reason for
Well, we don't miss those, trust me.
Yes, we all remember that, yeah. I think that then it was, I think, also illustrates the importance of cash, because it was in a case where the government knew that there are lockdowns, there is no economic activity happening. Really, the only way you keep people alive, the only way you keep the economy still running is if you give people money, or you allow people to have some kind of money so they can spend and meet their needs. And there were many different types of programs that were targeted at this.
Which was so interesting. They keep you at home and they give you money.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, for example, you had things like UIF TERF scheme, which was for people who were in employment but had lost their employment, so they got UIF. But the SRD...
We had a lot of retrenchments during COVID.
Exactly. There were a lot of retrenchments. Mm-hmm. And so the UIF was there for them. But the issue in South Africa we have, of course, in our context of extreme unemployment, is that we had a lot of working age people who weren't covered by UIF. And so none of those existing programs that the government had, where during COVID they expanded, there wasn't a way to reach those people. And they figured, hey, there will be households where no one is employed, or someone is employed but they're in informal employment, and they can't work, for example, they can't work their stall, and so they don't have any access to income. And so the solution to that was the SRD grant, seen as a temporary cash transfer. But of course, it was there to fix the issue of unemployment during COVID, but we all understand that unemployment didn't start with COVID, and obviously didn't end with COVID.
So
a lot of those conditions that made it important to have the SRD grant in the first place persisted post-COVID, which is why we've seen the grant remain.
And it's still continuing. And it makes me wonder, why is it that now we have all these grants that you mentioned? We've got child grant, we've got pension grant, and now the SRD grant. But why are still people in poverty in South Africa when we've been given so much grants?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. So why are so many people still in poverty? One, I would say the grants themselves are probably the most effective tool we have at alleviating poverty. So without them, our levels of poverty that are already pretty high would be much, much higher. So for example, we know now that around half of South African households receive some type of grant. So it's an
Which
important
makes it
lifeline.
some type of income, like you explained earlier on.
So it guarantees that there is some type of income that we have. But why we still have poverty in South Africa is that a lot of them, of course, there are issues with the economy. The economy isn't creating enough jobs. We know, for example, the best way to
I
get
mean,
someone
you
out of
would know
poverty is a
this.
job.
You are like doing your master's in this field.
So it's that, but because we of many issues, structural issues, the government and the economy is simply isn't providing enough jobs. You need a way to keep people out of hunger in the interim. And of course, grants can also be a tool to increase economic activity, which I'll talk about later. But why we still see people in poverty, even with grants, I think the short answer to that would be that many of the grants simply aren't enough, right? They aren't at levels that are enough for people to overcome what's usually called a poverty trap. Poverty trap means simply that you don't have enough money to take yourself out of poverty.
Which is a sad reality that a lot of South Africans are still facing. So at least we do have the grants. It's not like we're not grateful. We're just saying they're not enough, you know. But where does this money come from? The UBI money. Where does it come from?
So the money, of course, would come from the fiscus. What we envision is this is a type of progressive policy that would be implemented by a government. So where the money would come from is it would be raised by government. So the government would have to find ways to resources. And we have a number of proposals for this because I think it's important to start thinking about alternative financing mechanisms in South Africa as well. We saw that budget debacle we had earlier this year with the tax and the VAT. And that the argument from National Treasury, because what we've been seeing in the last couple of years is they've been cutting spending on many important social areas, things like education and healthcare have been cut. And essentially,
Which doesn't make sense.
it doesn't make sense because that's just a way to further harm all of us and hurt the economy. And it's not providing growth. They say that they do it so they can reduce the debt level, but it's important to target debt payment costs and not the debt level. And if you're not growing, you're not paying off your debt. So what's important then is that we need to develop alternative financing mechanism. We can't continue just cutting things that the government spends on because that's going to start impact. It already is actually
Even
impacting
future
people's lives.
impact, it's just not immediate, but also future.
Also future impact. So the grant would have to be resourced by progressive ways of financing, many that aren't tapped into in South Africa. So for example, things like wealth taxes that we talk about, where the experts agree in our case that we don't do enough to tax wealth. We tax income at quite a high level, but there's an important difference there, distinction between income and wealth. Because income is what many, especially the middle classes, that's their main source of income. But a lot of rich people aren't earning income or money through the labor market. They do it through assets and investments, and that's wealth. And we don't do enough to tax wealth. And while South Africa is said, and it's true, is the most unequal country in terms of income in the world, wealth inequality is even more unevenly distributed than income. So there's a
The
statistics that
margins are
find,
scary from poor people to wealthy people. It's like, are these people living in the same country? Because you're like,
And the scary statistic, one that I saw just a few months ago, was that around half of people in South Africa actually
Around
don't have
half.
any wealth. They have negative wealth. So nothing in their name, they actually owe more than they own. So wealth is massively unequally distributed. And that's an avenue, for example, that could be tapped into to finance a progressive policy like a basic income, which more equitably distributes resources.
And I like the fact that you mention also the topic around tax and VAT, because also in one of your interviews, I learned that there are people out there who actually don't believe in the SRD grants. Mm. They feel like, you know, justice is when everybody works for their own food. They put it in those exact words, actually, in one of your social media comments. And then they also, there are people who are, no, if you give people grants, you are making them lazy. What are these grants for? What do you have to say around people who think that way?
So what I'd say to people who think that way, who think that the people, it's going to make people lazy, people should work for, it's a layered, I think I would say a number
it
of
is
things.
I mean, it is layered.
I think the easiest would be maybe to tell them to consult the research, but that's a little bit flippant, so maybe I can explain.
I think I would like they must just have a day in a marginalized person's life, and maybe that would probably change their perspective, because I feel like they're speaking from a point of privilege. You know, it's easy to say people will be lazy when you've never slept without food, when you've never been deprived of education and being forced to work at a young age because you have to meet ends. So I think it's a lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of South Africans are on, I said like half of households in South Africa are on social grants or some type of grant. And these households don't stop working. People don't stop trying to improve their lives. That's what we've seen. That's what the research shows as well. So for the SRD grant, there was a paper that came out of UCT, a number of papers, actually, UCT, from these authors.
Mm-hmm.
But very important for the grant, because they found that it increases the chances of someone searching for work. It increases the chances of someone starting their own business. So when it comes to the topic around work, I mean, people want to work in South Africa.
There are constraints
to the labor market.
I mean, the system is created to make people want to work.
Exactly.
So they do want to work. It's not like people don't want to work.
Yeah, and the issue is that there aren't enough jobs for everyone, and you need to be able to have a way to not let people starve. But also, like I just said, the grants also allow people to create their own work or find their ways into employment, because things like searching for a job, for example, aren't free. There's another study I'll reference by an organization called Youth Capital, and the youth-based organization. They every year do a study where they quantify how much it costs for a young person to search for a job in South Africa.
Mm.
I think their latest says that it costs you around 1,500
rand a month
to look for work. And anyone who has had like prolonged periods of income of job searching, even for a few weeks, you know how intense it is, how difficult it is, you know, submitting CVs, printing, transport to and from town centers, to attend
online
interviews, commuting, all of those things take a lot of money. It isn't free. And so that's, I think,
and this is just for job searching, you know, because I'm like thinking the SRD grant is like 370 and then you need like 1.5 for you to apply for a job. And that's outside like your basic needs, like food.
So you still need to eat.
I know I'm not the mathematician here, but the math is not mathing. Yeah. And now it actually leads me to perhaps what conversations are we supposed to be having with the wealthy people? Because you spoke of different classes. You spoke of the middle class. You spoke of the wealthy people, and what roles they would be playing in making it easier. You know, what conversations are we supposed to be having with them?
I mean, with them, it's to say that we all benefit from living in a more equal society. Everyone does. The poor, the wealthy, everyone benefits. Because things like crime, for example, and this is actually a theory in economics, in the study of inequality. Crime is massively linked with inequality. So countries that are more unequal tend to have more crimes.
It makes a perfect sense with the research that we were speaking about, where we said, you know, in Namibia, when they had the grants, then crime declined.
Exactly. Because I think that there could be even two elements to crime. So you have, of course, you'll have economic crimes of opportunity when people don't have jobs, they don't have economic opportunities. That's an easy resort, and it just makes the country more.
And we're not saying it's okay for people to commit crime because they don't have money.
Yeah, it's
we're
not
just
okay,
saying
but
there's
it's
a direct link, and it's
link.
According to research.
Yeah, and I think the second element of it, which is a little bit more abstract, but I think inequality also takes us away from each other, like in terms of our humanity.
Hmm.
I think it makes it difficult to respect and see each other as human beings.
That is so true.
Live such different lives. So
that is so true.
We want a society where we value our economic, no, social bonds. We value everyone's inherent value just by being a human being. I think you achieve that when you reduce inequality. And so that's the interest in all of our interests. Actually, we want to live in a society where we can trust each other, where we don't have to be scared. Rich, wealthy people don't have to spend thousands on security, for example. It's just the link I was talking about in economics, that there's that strong link there, that more equal societies, people spend less on security guards and high private walls, which are a massive feature in our South African suburbs, for example.
Wow. And perhaps with all the information that you are giving us right now, I mean, October is a big month when it comes to like SRD grants. I hear there might be an increase in others, as per usual. What is some of the research that IEJ particularly has discovered with that?
So when it comes to grant increases, that is, yes, October is the month when a lot of the grants are going to be increasing. Unfortunately, not all of them. And for some of these, increases are also very minor. A lot of them are around 10 rands.
That's usually the child grant and the SRD grant.
Mm. Mm. So the child grant and the SRD are actually not going to be receiving any type of increase.
Imagine.
Which is bad, because the reason for a lot of these increases, for example, with the old age pension, isn't even so that pensioners can buy more with their money. It's just so they can keep up with inflation.
I was about to say that.
So if you aren't giving SRD grant recipients or child support grant recipients that inflation, it essentially means that
when bread last week was 5 rands and this week is 50 rands, you're saying, no, exactly, that's still going to cover you.
And it's not going to. So what we've seen a lot with the SRD, it was 350 when it was introduced in 2020. It went up last year in May by 20 rands to 370, but it hasn't seen any increases since then. And some calculations that we've done is we see that the grant, for it to be able to, in 2025, buy as much food as it was able to in 2020, would have needed to be at around 500 rands now, and it's only at 370. So it means that the SRD grant recipients are much poorer now in 2025 than they were in 2020 without receiving these increases.
And those were the decisions that were made during the lockdown, where people lost jobs, where somebody who was earning more than 350 or 370 now earns 370 and still cannot meet ends. Yeah. It's so sad. I know I mentioned earlier on about some countries that have had the UBI, one being Kenya and the one being Namibia. But are there any other countries perhaps where you've researched on how they use the system, how it has benefited them?
So no country has like fully implemented a UBI, but we have those really great examples. So like Kenya and Namibia are the best examples we have in Africa. We have others that have implemented what they call them UBI pilots. South Africa actually just did one, a very small one, with TVET students. But essentially, the way they work is they try to simulate or show us exactly what impact a UBI would have in the country. So in Kenya, they go into specific villages and they give everyone in that village a basic income. They did the same thing in Namibia. And there have been many basic income pilots around the world. Brazil, I think, is moving quite fast in terms of implementing.
Oh, is it?
So they have a town at a municipal level called Marica, and there they have a basic income that's run by the municipality. They are, I think it's an industry-heavy town. Like, they're involved in, I'm not sure if it's mining or metalwork, that type of heavy industry.
Yeah.
But the municipality essentially collects those revenues that they receive from that very profitable industry, and they're using it to fund a basic income. So essentially, I mean, that's a really good example of how you have a natural resource that the country is benefiting from, but then ensuring that everyone in that town receives it. So they're very close to a basic income. Almost everyone there receives it, and it's unconditional and also has amazing benefits.
Well, it actually does. And it actually takes me to my next question, which is, what are some of the lessons that we can get from that, seeing that it actually works? You know, what are some of the lessons we could take?
I think the lessons that we can take, I think the most important one is, I think for South Africa, we need a radical economic policy. I mean, we need something that's going to break us out of this low growth threshold that we're in. And I think bold, progressive policies like basic income, I think, the lesson there is that something like that is important, and something like that can do a lot more than just alleviating poverty or hunger, but it can actually grow the economy. And I think if the government took that lesson to heart, I think that they would, they would see the value in investing in people, because you invest in people, you give people money, they spend it in their communities, it grows local economies. It creates multiplier effects, essentially, where that initial investment that you give to someone, that maybe 350 or 1,000 rands that you give to someone, through them spending it, someone receiving it in their community, hiring people, spending it on their business, it eventually creates a lot more money than that initial investment of 1,000 rands. And I think if we took that to heart, I think we would see that that's definitely the type of radical policy we need to break us out of the slow growth that we're in.
So contrary to the fact that it actually makes people lazy, it actually helps so much in the society. And just a little detour, I just want to find out, how do you think the economy affects climate change?
So I think when it comes to the structure of the economy and the climate, I mean, the unfair thing is that a lot of the unequal distribution of wealth would also be mirrored in the case of the climate. And it's because a lot of the, I would call them risks and opportunities around climate are not necessarily evenly distributed, especially outside of, say, a just energy transition, if you're aiming to make it more equal. What that means is there are people who, through polluting and harming the climate over the years, have become extremely wealthy in that. And because they've got the resources, they'll
be insulated
from any climate disasters. Whereas poor people who didn't benefit much from any of that.
Or at all.
In fact, mostly not at all. The risks aren't evenly distributed, because when it comes to things like floods or droughts, they don't have money to insulate themselves. So there are people who benefit from harming the climate, and then the people who are hurt are those who weren't even involved. And that's how it affects the economy. And that's, I think, also why I'd say it's important. Basic income becomes important in that situation, because if you're distributing income more fairly, you give everyone an opportunity to build that resilience, which is important, I think, especially in the case of climate. We wrote a fact sheet series last year on it. And one of the arguments that I found when I was doing my research is the amazing studies that have been done on that relationship between cash and the climate. So, for example, in Bangladesh, there was going to be a flood, and they had technology that was able to predict when this flood was going to hit. And then they were able to use money to quickly give it to people who were in these areas where the flood was going to hit. And what happened is the people who received that money were much more likely to have their assets safe after the flood versus those who didn't receive any income. They were less hurt. They were able to move, or even after, they were able to reinvest in their businesses. So a lot of those concepts that we talk about when it comes to basic income are especially important as well when it comes to climate and building resilience and allowing people to recover from disasters.
So there is a direct link to climate change and the economy. And there's a word that you used that I liked. It was catchy. There was some alliteration there. I think you said cash what?
I'm not sure.
Okay, it's all right. Maybe we'll catch it on later on. So seeing that you just gave us the information that you gave us now, I just want you to share perhaps with somebody who's at home on the basic things they can do, to learn about our discussion today. What are some of the things that they can learn from this conversation, whether it's UBI, whether it's about climate change, or just general what we've been discussing?
Yeah, so what I think people can learn, I would just say for interest sake, especially if someone is curious about the topic, they should try to read up on the concept of basic income and social grants. I think in South Africa, I would say it's important that we all improve our literacy on social grants, because they form such an important part of our economy. So many people receive them. We spend billions on them. But a lot of people still don't really understand, one, how they work, or two, what their benefits are. So I would say start there. And then I would say that for anyone who is involved in political organizing, that social issues and basic income and just in general, climate and social protection, all those things should be demands that they make on policymakers, so that those becomes things that feature in our policy moving forward.
Yeah,
make it popular and talk about it.
Yeah, and it also brings me to the question where, you know, seeing that there are people who are against, you know, these SRD grants, what does the future look like for UBI, particularly in South Africa? What does it look like?
Yeah, so I think the future for UBI, future for SRD grant in South Africa, start with the SRD. I think it's a little complicated. I think we're at a point where the government has for a number of years now been signaling that they aim to move away from the SRD grant and make it something more permanent. So the way that they've been treating it since 2020 is they've been treating it on a very like temporary basis. So they renew it on the day at the budget. So like we'll hear now, there'll be a medium-term budget speech coming soon.
Yeah.
And they'll say that there isn't going to be an SRD grant next year. And they've been saying that for the last 5 years. And
yeah.
Then at the last minute, they reintroduce it. So they've been saying they want to make it permanent. But I think that what we're going to be paying attention to, really what's going to be contentious, is what exactly this is going to look like. Because it's, I think it was one of their promises, and a lot of parties especially had made some type of commitment to basic income or expanding the SRD. So last year during elections, we had done this research report, it's called an election scorecard, where we scored parties on their policies on basic income, and we used that scorecard to reach out to them essentially and say, hey, you scored a D on F on our scorecard, would you like to implement this style policy? Many of them
was this the IEJ?
Yes, it wasn't it was us at IEJ, but also with Universal Basic Income Coalition, which I'll talk about them in a little bit, that we're part of. Yeah, so that was one way we saw that there is, at least when it comes to manifestos, there are some promises that are made around the grant. So I think there's that. So it's either we see the SRD grant get turned into some form of basic income. Of course, it wouldn't be like immediately a basic income policy. It would probably be progressively realized, which is also what we argue for. So progressive realization means you introduce it slowly, work towards it. So instead of giving it to everyone immediately, you could start by giving it to everyone who lives in poverty, maybe. And then you say, now everyone who earns minimum wage or 2 times the minimum wage, 10 times the minimum wage, and expand it slowly like that until it eventually gets to everyone. The other side of it is we might see it, which would be unfortunate, is see it turned into a job seekers or work seekers grant. So the way that the thinking around this is someone gets a grant, and then, but in order for someone to continue to receive that grant, they have to prove to the government that they are searching for work. Of course, that's based on the logic that the grant makes people not want to work, which I think from our conversation here, we've seen that isn't
true. That would be very wise to implement also. Because with what you're saying, I mean, I read on a Facebook joke where somebody was saying, I think they should stop giving us these 350s in bits and pieces. They must just give us our 1 million, and whoever wastes it, and whoever, you know. But it speaks to, there are, although it's a joke, it's very good that also as a country we hold people accountable, because this is not like a, hey, you're getting one, everybody's getting one. It's more of, it's for a good cause. We want to see people get better, you know, develop themselves. Like we say, we want to see crime declining. We want to see more people going to school. And maybe this question is going to sound like a little bit monotonous, but I want, for the sake of emphasizing it for you, just to touch base again on the importance of having the UBI, like to an average person, to somebody listening at home, you know, to understand like the average person, how it impacts them.
Yeah. So I think to the average person, the importance of it would just be to say, I think it would be good to live in a country where everyone's needs are taken care of. Right? One where children don't starve or grow up malnourished. I think that's at the most basic level what a UBI guarantees. Right? It means that everyone can at least meet their basic needs. And so if you aren't worrying about your basic needs, then people can take economic risks or invest in themselves and go to school instead of having to prematurely start looking for work, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think I would say that for basic income, I think it's important that we ensure that everyone's most basic needs in society are met, because everyone contributes to our society. And so it's only fair that everyone gets to benefit in some way.
And, you know, one of the things that you touched that moved my heart closely was when you highlighted the fact that it combats issues like inequality, you know. And, you know, when the world is looking at South Africa, I mean, with the Bokkies and rugby, everybody just thinks we are this phenomenal country where everybody gets along. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to believe that we do, especially in matches like that. But then after the match, what happens? You know, then somebody else goes, takes a taxi downtown to Alexandra or Soweto, and another one goes to Sandton or flies on a plane to Cape Town, you know, in an expensive hotel. And we don't want to be a country like that. You know, we want to be a country that is unified, like it says, you know, united in our diversity. So, Sianda, if you can just paint a picture of a recipient of a person who received the SRD grant, what would it be like?
Yeah. So if I would paint a picture of SRD grant, the first and most important way to characterize them would just be to look at who qualifies for that grant. Mm-hmm. So the qualification criteria is extremely low at the moment. It is anyone who earns under 673 rands in South Africa. And that was based on the 2021 food poverty line. So food poverty line is what Stats SA determines is the absolute basic amount of money that someone needs in order to be able to meet their basic needs. And that's just to have enough energy for the day. That's since been adjusted multiple times. It's now standing at 796 rands.
Which is still little.
Yeah. So someone who qualifies for the grant is someone who is living in extreme poverty by definition. And what that looks like is, unfortunately, it's very bleak, because South Africa has issues around food security and hunger. So we know, for example, that around 1 in 4 households in South Africa are food insecure. Mm. What this means is that they don't have enough money to eat a nutritious basket of food. Mm. It's a shocking statistic that came out of Wits University a few years ago that found that 1 in 5 households in South Africa have to send someone out to beg for food. Mm. So unfortunately, a lot of the SRD grant recipients are people who would fall into that category, number one. Two, of course, our issue or with unemployment means that the SRD grant recipients is also obviously unemployed, because they earn so little, so they couldn't be earning that much in the labor market. So it's people who are unemployed, many of whom are women. I think the majority of SRD grant recipients are actually women, and many are also caregivers for their children. So by virtue of the social assistance system, a lot of them also earn the child support grant on behalf of their kids. But because the SRD grant is so little, it essentially means that many of them have to substitute or use that cash that is from the child support grant to meet not only their child's needs, but also attempt to meet their own needs, which just is extremely difficult. But because even that child support grant at around 575 is also below the food poverty line, and it is also below how much is estimated is the cost to feed a child. So it's a very difficult life. And I think further to add on to that is that because the means test threshold is so low, it also discourages people from searching for work. So research that we did last year with SRD grant recipients is we spoke to a lot of them, and they tell us things like they were using the grant to invest in their business, for example. But the second they started earning any type of money from the grant, they lost access to it. Because the way it's set up is at 673, which is so low. The second you start earning just a little bit above that, you lose access to the grant.
Which is so sad, because it could have assisted so much with the momentum of keeping the business to run at least for a year or two, you know.
Exactly. So it hurts people who are trying to like make lives for themselves. Furthermore, it's even things like the access now when it comes to the grants. Even when someone receives money from their family to say, help them survive at least 1 month, because you see how it's not enough to live on, they also get punished, because again, that means test threshold is so low. And often it will characterize any type of money that someone receives. Even if it's not income, it can be a gift, it can be a loan, it can be one person in the house giving it to another to buy groceries on behalf of the household. Those all become reasons for someone to become excluded. So the life of an SRD grant recipient, I think, is very bleak. And unfortunately, they're faced with unemployment, food insecurity.
This is just really touching my soul and heart, because I know of stories of people who said, I stopped receiving a grant because of the reasons that you've just mentioned. But also people have also said things like, to restart the process also is hideous. You know, you've been receiving these 350s, like for 370s rather, for like 3, 4, 5 months. And then one day, Sianda is so excited to meet you and seeing that you are a person that's probably trying to start out a business in the township, and they decide to give you like R1,000. And then suddenly you stop getting the grant, and the business doesn't do so well, because, you know, with business, it can never be predictable in terms of how well it will do or not do. And then suddenly, because Sianda came into your hood and gave you R1,000 to support your business, now you are no longer receiving a grant, and then you must go back through the process, and now you have to explain yourself, and now there are documents you must produce. Now you don't even have the money to print out the documents, and for another 6 months you don't have the grant, and it's really ridiculous. But thank you so much for taking us through that. It really is interesting. I am people. I will definitely be checking out the website, because you are doing an amazing job. And now that you spoke about mobilizing, which is what we do best, how do you think we could best assist, help mobilize these great initiatives that UBI Coalition is doing, or perhaps the IEJ, or perhaps you as an individual? How do you think we can best support or help mobilize?
Yeah, so how I think we can best support is, I mean, I think doing a podcast like this is one step to it, because I think that there's an element of shout out. So directly engaging like policymakers and trying to get them to implement specific policies. So of course, if people have connections to policymakers or their politicians, it would be through that. But an important part, I would say, is also just public knowledge and public knowledge and interest in the topic, because essentially we want to make it like a popular demand that everyone understands and everyone demands. Because, of course, if it's going to be a policy that's introduced but it's not popular, it's not going to last very long. So I think it would be in educating, getting the literacy on the basic income, learning about it. We also have been doing quite a bit when it comes to just reaching out to everyone and just trying to educate on what the basics of it are. And I think that's definitely how it's just to get the word out and spread the message.
Yeah, basically what I'm saying is that if you need anything in terms of mobilizing, shout out. We are literally here. Mr. Patuza, we're talking about real life issues here when it comes to, you know, the recipients of the SRD grants. And these are human beings who, like you said, mostly are women. Women are always concerned about feeding their families and children, seeing the stats of absent fathers in South Africa. You know, however, every time and again, you hear people complaining of how frustrating the system is. You know, it's some way, it's like it's set up to discourage people to even apply, you know, or reapply, because we also spoke about the fact that there are people who get the grant TP and then 1, 2, 3, they lose the grant and they have to appeal. And they get so frustrated. It's so saddening to see, you know, a good thing, which is the receiving of the grants, you know, now becoming this, you know, hideous process, frustrating process, which was actually meant to be a hopeful initiative. So what are some of the resources you would perhaps advise people out there to use to apply or even reapply for the grant?
So I think one is to just what the resources I would say. I think before I even get to that, I think it would just be to acknowledge the how difficult the SRD grant application process is and the design of it. And we've done research on this. There was also a court case against the government on this, and the High Court ruled in our favor, essentially agreeing that a lot of the measures that were put in place were unconstitutional and unfair. So people being frustrated or disillusioned with the grant isn't surprising at all. It's a finding that we also found in our own research. And yeah, so it's very difficult because someone will go from receiving a grant and then it stops and they don't have any explanation. There's an appeals process, but the appeals process is fully automated. And what that means is people cannot submit any type of information to the government to explain their situation. So if they're excluded for any of the reasons I mentioned earlier, which is for things that aren't income, then the appeals process, which is supposed to mediate that process, essentially doesn't work because it also just reruns the exact same procedure. And so that's also like the type of the opportunity for recourse people have essentially doesn't work. But there are organizations that work with grant recipients and essentially help them navigate this difficult terrain. So one of those is hashtag pay the grants, which were, of course, partners in UBIC, the Universal Basic Income Coalition that we're part of. So we work closely with them there. But there were also co-applicants on the court case that we had against the government. So they also have take a very strong interest in this matter. And they have people who have experience with the SRD grant application process, because many of the people who are volunteers that pay the grants are recipients or grant beneficiaries themselves. So that's a resource that people can reach out to. You can look at our socials. You can directly reach out to me if you find my details on the website, and I'll point you to them. There's also Black Sash. I also spoke about briefly. They're also part of the Universal Basic Income Coalition, and they are mainly lawyers who help people navigate, again, difficult issues or legal situations, and the grants fall under that. So they also help people put in applications. They help people navigate the grant system. So if people are finding difficulties with navigating it, I think that there are those organizations that they can reach out to. The Children's Institute as well, based in UCT, they mainly help child support grant recipients. So they also have a help desk. All of these organizations I've mentioned have help desks, which is someone who's informed about the process that they can reach out to, who then helps them navigate it.
Oh, okay. It makes sense, because I was going to ask you a follow-up question on that, which is, are these now walk-ins? Because I know with the hashtag, you get it on the socials, but you know the socials are not for everyone. There are people who don't even have access to data, and there are also people who are slightly older who are also recipients of the grant, like take a 47-year-old person who's not maybe into social media. Yeah. So I just wanted to find out if there are walk-ins or there are telephone numbers that they can call, you know, to contact these institutions. But thank you so much for sharing that insightful information.
Yeah.
And what are the roadblocks that people encounter when applying or reapplying even?
So the roadblocks that people encounter when they apply for the grant, I can break it down into, I'll say, four steps, because we said the procedure we took when analyzing our data for a research report we had last year. But essentially, there are roadblocks at every single stage of the grant process. So the first process would be applying, right? But applying for the grant doesn't work like any of the other grants. So someone cannot walk into a SASSA office, get a form there, fill it in. It happens exclusively online. So someone needs to have a smartphone that has access to the internet that will allow them to apply for it. And of course, when we're talking about people living in extreme poverty, this isn't something that a lot of people have. A concession that was made
was that now I'm being penalized for not having a smartphone.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the things the government had said was, will allow at least five people to apply on a single number. But of course, that's also extremely difficult, because now someone has to rely on a neighbor who can move, for example, in order to be able to receive their grant or apply for it. And that'll be an issue when it comes to payment. So in the applications process, of course, there are issues there. There are digital barriers. So access to the internet, access to a mobile phone. Furthermore, someone also needs to have a bank account. in order to apply for the grant. But that's also not the reality for many people. Mm. So many people either do not have any type of bank account or they share a bank account with someone else.
I mean, they don't have the money.
Yeah, to open one. And because there are procedures and barriers there to application as well. And what we found in the research that we conducted last year on SRD grant applicants who had been excluded from the grant, we found that the majority of our participants had actually opened bank accounts for the first time in order to apply for the SRD grant, which just shows you the level of financial exclusion that we have in South Africa. The second barrier is in approvals. So the way in which the means test or like the eligibility criteria is determined is through that automated bank verification that I spoke about. But that is a very blunt instrument that doesn't distinguish the types of inflows that someone gets in their bank account. So there isn't a way, because it's also fully automated, it's just the government created contracts with banks, private banks who receive people's data or information, and they just look at everything that comes into someone's bank account and classify all of that as income. So even things like child maintenance payments that a mother would receive on behalf of a child, all those become reasons for people to be excluded. And so that's a massive barrier. Similarly, there's also database verification, which the government does, where they have linked up with these different databases from all the other government departments that are there. So for example, like NSFAS or UIF or PERSAL. But the issue here is that a lot of these government databases are actually out of date and inaccurate. So someone can apply for the grant and be denied on basis that they are receiving NSFAS, for example, when maybe they were a student 5 or 10 years ago and are no longer receiving that support.
Imagine.
So that's another barrier. Thirdly, it's in payment. So now, even after someone has applied, they've been approved, there are also barriers to payment. So one way that's happening is through a biometric verification process. So now people are required to complete some type of biometric verification in order to receive their grants.
Mm-hmm.
But the way this works is it's also fully online and fully automated. Someone needs a smartphone with a good quality camera that allow them to be able to take a selfie to apply for the grant. Two, they need an ID card. So many people we know hold green ID books, for example, those do not work, because what the government says is if you have
that's ridiculous.
If you have a book, then they can't match your photo to what's at Home Affairs, and so you're going to fail the verification. So that biometric verification is an issue. And of course, just receiving payments, because in order to receive your payment, you need to have that phone that you used to originally apply on. But like I said, they allow people to apply on more than one phone. So if you applied with someone 2 years ago and that person has since moved, you're not going to get the SMS and you're not going to be able to receive a one-time PIN to reset it.
Yeah.
That also makes it difficult. Finally, the appeals process, which also requires that you are online and have a phone in order to appeal, and you can only appeal on the phone you applied on. But again, the appeals process, like we said, is essentially rigged in that it's not going to give people positive outcomes. Like, the success rates are less than 0.5% when it comes to appeals. So even if you've been denied for legitimate reasons, then there isn't any type of recourse that people have access to.
Sienda, with everything that you're saying, I feel like the system is kind of like designed to exclude people deliberately, you know, without accusing anybody. But I mean, some of the pointers that you said, I even blurbed out, this is ridiculous, because really a green ID card, is that stopping you from receiving a grant, really? You know, and in as much as we're living in the fourth or fifth industrial revolution, which we don't have a problem with, I also feel that as a country, we have a problem when it comes to transitioning into things. You know, we are rooting, of course, for, you know, digital experiences and all of that. It makes work so much easier. But why is it that when you're transitioning into that, you're letting go of the other aspect, which was still working well, especially when it comes to issues like the SRD grants, where we know that the majority of the people who are receiving it don't even have the smartphones, don't even have the computers at home, you know. So I really wish, you know, they could really look into the system, you know, and perhaps, you know, radically start implementing things that will actually help people receive the grants as fast as they can. So also, if we can just break it down to like a five-year-old, perhaps, what would you say an SRD grant is?
So SRD grant, like I had said earlier, was introduced during COVID. It was income support for those who were not covered by UIF. What it is it is a cash transfer. It's a social grant that someone receives on a month-to-month basis.
Oh, yeah.
So we see it as a step towards UBI because it already kind of takes that form. So it's not conditional. So someone doesn't have to prove that they're partaking in ABC type behaviors in order to receive it. But there's, of course, an applications process. So the criteria for it is that someone needs to have income or financial means below 670, mm-hmm. 672 rands. They mustn't receive any type of government support. They can't live in a government institution, but essentially they would apply for it. They would apply for it online. And the way it works is then it's slightly different from other grants in that other grants is someone places an application at the office. It is verified once at the office, so they determine if someone qualifies or not, and then they start receiving it on a month-to-month basis. With the SRD, it's different in that eligibility is determined on a month-to-month basis. So every single month, the government is going to look at someone's income and determine whether or not they qualify to receive it. So which is why you can get things like irregular payments. You can get it in Feb, May, maybe not get it in March and April because of the way that it's designed, because it's verified every single month. But if someone does qualify for it and they do pass the eligibility criteria, then it is a 370 rands cash grant. So it's provided to an individual in cash that they can withdraw at a bank or at a supermarket. They used to be able to collect it in person, but that was closed down as well. But in the simplest terms, that's how the SRD works, I think, yeah, and could be a step towards a basic income because it already has the basics in there, like the income aspect and the unconditionality aspect of it.
And just a closing question when it comes to the SRD grants, because research also shows that there's like 23% of people who perhaps believe they don't deserve to get the grant. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they don't go register, you know, probably some of them even have the cell phones. What are some of the things you can say to those people just to encourage them to, you know, sign up and actually collect the grants?
Yeah, to those people, I would say, one, of course, I think I understand why some people who, even if they do qualify, would believe that they don't, because of the way that the verification system has been working. It is in a way that ends up excluding a lot of people who should actually be qualifying for the grant. So we have a statistic that there are experts have determined, even the government, Department of Social Development themselves say that there are around 16 to 17 million people who are eligible for the grant based on the fact that many people earn below 662 rands per month. But the number of people actually receive the grant is much closer to 7 and 8 million. So a lot of people end up who should be receiving it end up not receiving it. But I would say to those people that I think that they should try to apply. They should try to reach out to someone who's more knowledgeable about the process. So if they can reach out to someone like a volunteer from hashtag pay the grants or BlackSash to be able to help them navigate the system a lot more. And I think people should not feel that they don't deserve it because it is an entitlement.
Just give it a try.
And it is a constitutional right that people have. Yeah. So like Section 27 of the Constitution states, among other things, that like we have a right to food, water. We also have a right to social assistance when we can't feed ourselves and our families. So that is someone's entitlement. It is their right, and they should not feel that they don't deserve it because of stigma, whatever other reason exists.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope somebody who's listening at home will definitely, you know, at least attempt, you know, or try to apply, or perhaps advise somebody they know who, you know, a lot of people talk about these things. I ask this because there are people who heard that Sianda did not get the grant. So now I, as Queen, now am deciding because you were declined, then I no longer go. So with this information given, I hope that somebody can share it with somebody who say, no, I was declined because perhaps I have a business. You don't. So you can go ahead and try. And yeah, hopefully even the links to the podcast would be shared to so many other people so that they receive this knowledge and we see an increase with people actually going to apply for the SRD grants. And there you have it. We've just wrapped out an awesome interview with Sianda Paduza. Sir, I don't know where to start when it comes to gratitude. Thank you so much for such an informative discussion. You know, it's not just only theoretical. very, very practical. And I hope the people who are watching at home can just, you know, learn, share, like I said. So thank you so much for taking your time to be with us, to share all this information that you've shared with us. We really, really appreciate you here at Mobilize. And we really look forward to perhaps have another session with you in the near future.
Thank you, Queen, for having me.
So to everybody watching at home, do like, comment, subscribe. We really look forward to reading your comments. We do read your comments, by the way. Share some of the things that you learned. Share some of the challenges you have faced with regards to the topics that we discussed. But for me, Queen the Empowerer, I look forward to the next episode with you. See you next time on the Mobilize Podcast. Bye. Thank you for watching the Mobilize Podcast. You know where to find us.